For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I'm here with Max Linsky from Longform, but Aaron Lammer, who you might be expecting, I know we were expecting, has gone home sick.
He went home sick. He went to the nurse's office and the nurse told him to go home.
He legitimately seems to not be feeling well.
In his defense, he was translucent. I could see like all of his vital organs. And still he was like, I'll just stay, man. I'll just stay for and then do the podcast. But he like couldn't get complete sentences out. It was a bad scene.
So we better get this right.
Yeah, feel better.
Not having Aaron here. Well, Aaron's not here, but we do have an interview. And Max, who did you interview this week? It was a special one. It was a live.
Yeah, it was live. Aaron and I went to UC Irvine for this journalism conference, which was super fun. There was all kinds of long-form podcast veterans there. Mike Sager was hanging out and Jay Kang was there. But I did this live interview with Vanessa Gregoriadis, who writes for New York and Vanity Fair, and she's written for Rolling Stone in the past. She does all kinds of things, but you probably know her for her celebrity profiles. She is, I think she's the best celebrity profiler that we have. A note on this interview, we're going to pick it up actually after I asked her how she manages to make celebrity profiles not suck.
That's a good place to start.
Yeah, you know.
Any interview.
How do you not suck?
You know, I was talking to Aaron Lammer and he said a good place to start an email newsletter is at a place called Tiny Letter. He told me this even as he was sick, not feeling well. He said, don't forget Tiny Letter, a simple, powerful email newsletter from the good people at MailChimp. That's exactly what he said to me. But actually, that's not our only sponsor. We have a second sponsor.
Yeah, we're also sponsored this week by Audible. You know Audible. The good people at Audible will give you a free audiobook. All you need to do is go sign up audiblepodcast.com/longform.
All right, here's Max and Vanessa.
Well, I try to ride a line between pleasing the subject and also pleasing the reader. And I have, I think, done that in many cases, including Justin Bieber and Taylor Swift and other people who are like half my age. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, the key is always access, right? It's spending a good amount of time with that person, writing novelistically about them, thinking about it as if it was a short story. What do they look like? What are they eating? How do they eat? Do they have some bizarre OCD element that you can bring out? And just trying to make them a three-dimensional character.
Well, let's talk a little bit about access. I mean, it's hard to create a three-dimensional character if you only have half an hour with a publicist sitting next to you.
Right.
So how does that access happen? Like, is it a negotiation? How does that work?
Yeah. I mean, it's the least fun part of the job, that's for sure, because it involves negotiating for time or asking for time, getting a small amount of time, and then by virtue of your sparkling personality, trying to walk your way into more time. I mean, it's difficult. It certainly is difficult, and there's less and less access all the time. I mean, when I started doing this too many years ago to count, you know, we used to get like 3 days at Rolling Stone if we wanted it
right.
with an artist. Now, obviously, you get far less, but, you know, whatever. That's the way it goes.
Is there like a minimum that you won't go below? Do you have like
I read a
ground
cover
rules?
Story about Nancy Pelosi and I had 15 minutes with her. So, no. In other words. But, you know, it was like 15 minutes, but they were gracious enough and I was canny enough to make sure that those 15 minutes included her walking through a hallway in the Capitol, going to have a photo op, going into her office, and like then walking from there to another meeting. So, you know, strung
that
along.
That sounds like a lot of walking.
It was a lot of walking. It was not a lot of talking. And but, you know, Nancy Pelosi is not Miss Let Me Let It All Hang Out in the Interview anyway.
Right.
You know, she will, in some ways, 15 minutes with her, you know, obviously action is very important in profile writing. So just like it is in a play or a movie or whatever, you've got to have your people doing different things. In that case, 15 minutes with her going a lot of different places was much more valuable than an hour sitting there with her bringing it back to, you know, policy statements that I'd heard her make before. I mean, there's obviously a lot on the record that you can pull from.
When you do have more time with a subject, what do you do? I mean, Nancy Pelosi's probably not going to break, right?
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me like part of the sort of transaction in a celebrity profile is like they are trying to get press and attention without saying or doing anything they're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to write an article, and preferably they will say or do something they're not supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're obviously not going to do that until they sort of feel comfortable. So are there sort of like techniques, you know, the things you do to get people to kind of open up to you?
I mean, I can't give you away all my tricks. You know, I think that the problem is looking at it like there's something that you're trying to get them to do that they're not supposed to do. You have to, like, take all of that and just table it and not think about that stuff. Like, that's going to lead you down a path that might pay off once in a while, but it's not going to pay off every time. Because just setting people up to get them to say something that's going to make, like, the Us Weekly rounds is – first of all, not really my job, although, you know, you could argue that it is a little part of my job, but it's not really my job. And second of all, it's like people are smart, you know, particularly these people. They're sitting there going, when's she going to drop that question? Like, they know,
right.
You know. Every journalist who sits there is like, whether they if they have an hour, suddenly at minute 51, oh, here comes the question, you know,
right.
About – you're interviewing, you know, Angelina Jolie, and here comes the question about the marriage with Brad Pitt. You know, oh, this person has 2 hours. Huh, it'll come at 1:47. You know,
right.
This person has 2 days. Well, there is, I mean, they know what you're doing. So I think that the way to think about it is more like, let's have an actual, genuine, human, interesting conversation. Am I doing that to develop some trust? Yeah, of course. But it's actually interesting to me, like, what happened in your childhood? What were your parents like? Like, what are your real thoughts and dreams? Separate. Let's actually talk about the work that you do, but talk about it in a way that's accessible and interesting, not like, what was it like to work with Robert De Niro? Oh, my God, I'm so interested in your answer, which is always going to be, I was very excited to work with Robert. I have always really thought of him as my idol.
Yeah.
You know, like,
no one ever says, like, fuck De Niro.
Yeah, exactly. That's like, that doesn't happen. But, you know, if you say, like, look, you know, let's think about the different characters that you've played. Like, you know, you seem to always play women who are kind of cold and unemotional, you know, unemotional, not emotionally available, you know, concerned about, you know, everything falling apart or paranoid or whatever. Like, do you think that's true? That seems like that's what your characters are usually interested in. They'll be interested in talking about something like that. So, I mean, that's the way that I approach it much less from like a gotcha point of view than I do from just a like, let's try to have a real human conversation here and be like, you know, the way that celebrities talk about it is like, you know, they go out and they do a junket for a day or maybe a week. They're promoting their movie every single day or whatever art form it is that they're doing. And they're like, every journalist that comes in, they're like, I hope you're the person who's different. Like, I hope you're right. the one person who's going to not say, are you excited about working with Robert De Niro? Like, I hope you're the one person who's going to be like, do you like watermelon? Like, just answer weird questions and right. let's try to do that. You know, obviously, depending on how much time you have, there's a different, you know, kind of question you would ask, blah, 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 blah. I don't use notes or a list of questions at all. Some people use the same questions
you
every time.
You just come up with the watermelon question spur of the moment?
Yeah. I mean, I don't ask watermelon
questions. That's virtuoso question answer. I got like a whole notebook full of questions there.
I mean, I don't ask. I do ask questions about childhood. I just try to ask whatever I think the next interesting question would be, as though we're, you know, having a really uncomfortable blind date or something. Like,
here's another interesting question that I would like to ask you. How much research do you do before those things, and how conscious are you? I mean, like, you're writing about people that get written about all the time. Mm-hmm. You're writing about people that have been profiled many, many times in many, many magazines. Like, do you go and read all that stuff? Do you know exactly what's out there, or do you try and, like, turn it off and...
Oh, yeah. No, I know exactly what's out there. Yeah. I mean, I read everything that I can read. I mean, there are some magazines that are harder to get your hands on from, you know, archival stuff than not. Sometimes I'll even read, like, really bad unauthorized biographies of the people just to see, because those unauthorized biographies are just, like, a compilation of all the, you know, previous articles that have been written about somebody. Yeah, I mean, the point is to basically make sure that they don't say anything in those clips again. Like, right. everything that they should say to you should
know,
be different and original.
Right, you need to know if you're getting, like, a canned answer.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as you hear something that you've seen in clips, particularly if you've seen it more than once, you have to, like, immediately pivot and get out of it. I mean, there are people who will say, I don't. But, like, there are people who will be like, look, this is not cool. I don't want to talk about that stuff or whatever. But, I mean, I think I said, like, depending on who the person is, I mean, I think I did say, I had a phase of, like, a year where I used to say to the person at the beginning, like, let's try something. Don't say anything you've ever said before. Like, let's try to do that in this interview. And everybody's always been like, okay, you know. But I don't know. You know, people have all sorts of schemes of what they think works for them. You know, my scheme is no scheme. Is just being, like, really down to earth and just trying to have an interesting conversation.
We haven't done this kind of thing before, but I'm going to quickly interrupt this interesting conversation with Vanessa and tell you a little bit more about one of our sponsors, Audible. You know Audible, right? Audible is the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, phone, MP3 player. Wherever you're listening to this right now, Audible can get you a book. I've been on Audible for years. It's great. There are over 100,000 titles you can choose from, every genre, Audible as you covered. I just found this out, but you can even subscribe to The New Yorker through Audible. The whole thing's just read out loud for you every week. Sounds pretty great. Anyway, if you go right now to audiblepodcast.com/longform, that's audiblepodcast.com/longform, you can get the free audiobook of your choice. You can do that New Yorker subscription thing or pick up a book by one of the guests we've had on the show. Ted Gonover's books are on there, so are Susan Orlean's and Charles Duhigg's. You can listen to J. Caspian Kang's novel, all kinds of good stuff. Go get yourself a free book, audiblepodcast.com/longform. Okay, back to Vanessa.
Do you still enjoy doing it? You've been doing it for a while now.
I really haven't been doing that much celebrity profiling in the last couple of years, I have to say. I kind of got a little bit, like, I had, I had not a great experience with somebody who you really would expect to have a nice experience with, who is Shakira. And I was just like, I think Shakira is like the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back. Like, who knew?
What happened with Shakira?
I mean, it was just, you know, it was like one of these standard celebrity profiling nightmares where, like, you know, I flew from L.A. to the Bahamas, which is far, to meet her for 2 days for a cover of Rolling Stone. And I was going to Burning Man, and I, like, needed to be back on the West Coast to go to Burning Man to like meet an RV and my friends and this and that. And it was like my vacation.
We
and
should I say said that we, to them, we have like a hard stop here because you need to go to Coachella after this.
Exactly. Bye, guys. But, you know, I had said, and it's always with rock stars, like it's always like, you know, you get there and then you wait in the hotel for like a day or two until they're ready to see you. So I was like, look, you guys are pushing this date as far as I possibly can. I'm like, it's like 3 days. I have to leave. So I have to leave. I'm going to leave on that day. So 3 days I was going to be in the Bahamas and she was supposed to hang out with me for 2 of those days. So I like check into the hotel, the phone rings, and it's like the publicist assistant. And she's like, okay, I have you down tomorrow for lunch with Shakira. And here's the address. And I was like, okay, lunch and? And she was like, it's just lunch. And I was like, no, it's not. It's not just lunch. Like, I just flew to the Bahamas. And
just for the record here, you're complaining
to say,
about a flight to the Bahamas.
It was raining. Listen. Yes. I mean, I know. These are, you know, unfortunately, I do understand that complaining about going to meet, like, the biggest Latina rock star in the world, like, in the Bahamas is not a problem. But it's not cute after a while when things like this keep happening. And it all went south from there. Let's just put it that way. It was just, the whole thing was a huge mess. And it was an access mess.
We can stop talking about this. I'm going to like expose my complete lack of knowledge about Shakira very soon. It's going to get ugly. I wonder though, that like, it's, you know, that stopped being cute after a while. But like, does like seeing like behind the scenes, like seeing the sort of like apparatus of fame, does that get like boring after you've seen it that many times?
I mean, it does get a little boring in terms of like you always see that like the star's like best friend from high school happens to be their assistant and like their mom used to be their manager, but now she's been pushed to the side and there's like another manager there and there's always like, you know, the bodyguard. Like their entourage is always the exact same people, you know, that travel around with this rock star every place that they go. I love seeing behind the scenes. Like I love seeing that kind of stuff. I'm fascinated by it. I just think that at some point, fame, it's a dead end. Like it doesn't go anywhere. We're all excited about seeing famous people because it's interesting and exciting and fun to just glimpse that, you know, because it's so weird that we live in a society that idolizes these random like performers and then we see them beamed out in like mass media all over the place and we can talk about them. It's like we're, you know, the feudal serfs and they're like the lords and ladies. But after a while, it's just not that interesting. You don't know that person that well. Like the apparatus isn't that. It just, I don't know. I feel like I kind of, you know, I don't know if I aged out of it or I grew out of it or I just was just like, this is, you know, there's other things in the world that I rather apply myself to learning about, you know.
So what do you like to learn? What are you applying yourself to learn about now?
I learned a lot about synthetic drugs last month. And I don't know. I mean, I'm like a generalist writer. So I really like to do just I'm just curious. I just want to learn about new stuff that I don't know anything about. That's my primary motivation in doing the work that I do. And it's difficult because instead of being on a beat where you just keep covering, you know, the same stuff, so you know the press officer who works in the, you know, in the local precinct and you know all the lawyers in town and all of that, and you kind of have lunch with them and develop these relationships and they feed you information. Like I'm always the outsider who's just like parachuting in to try to say like, okay, what's going on here? And, you know, that can become its own cliche too of just like parachute in, make a couple of grand statements and get on, you know, the plane and go back to Burning Man. But like it's definitely much more fun than I think than being on a beat.
Well, let's sort of go back a little bit. Is that what got you interested in journalism in the first place? Like, were you a writer when you were young? How did you get started?
I mean, I was always a good writer. I was an English major. I went to Wesleyan in Connecticut. I did a lot of acting in plays there. And
did you write for the Argus?
I didn't even write for the Argus. No, I didn't. That was the school paper. I didn't write for the school paper. I have just one of these kind of, you know, ridiculous tales that unfortunately, this will not happen to you because this structure does not exist anymore in New York since there's like barely any magazines left and nobody has an assistant anymore. But back then, you know, you could be essentially a humanities major from a college and move to New York and get an internship, as I did at New York Magazine, and then quit the internship because you needed to make money, and then bump into somebody from the magazine on the subway. And they were like, oh, hi. Like, Kurt Anderson, who was the founder of Spy, you know, he was the editor of New York Magazine at the time. His assistant's going on vacation for 2 weeks. It was August. And we need somebody to fill in. Do you want to come and fill in? And I was like, oh, okay, that sounds good. Like, you're going to pay me. You know, I'll go. Sure. And so I went there, and it was a regular old school newsroom where there were no cubicles, and people actually talked to each other as opposed to now, which is just like click, 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 you know.
Yeah, I work in one of those, like, right. Library offices where it's like you're G-chatting the person 2 feet away from
exactly.
you.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, here we were like, I mean, super healthy, were shouting at each other. Like, I heard people, you know, arguing, you're a terrible writer, like whatever. There was like a
wait,
huge
people were
arguing.
Just sitting in New York Magazine yelling across
no,
the cubicle, you're a terrible
some
writer?
Some editor and this writer who, like, quit that week had some, you know, complete blowout right next to me. But in this, you know, it wasn't even cubicles, it was just desks. And they had me in the assistant's desk, which happened to be next to the managing editor's desk, who was an older woman. And I just thought, like, she's another assistant. So we were like talking about her life in Portland, Oregon, and how, like, we both like to, like, do, like, West African dance and drumming, and we're just like chilling out, blah blah blah. And meanwhile, she's like the person who hires and fires everybody. And then I was like, okay, bye you guys, like, I'm going back to, you know, whatever, have my weird job. And a month later, they called me up and were like, oh, do you want to be an assistant here? And I was like, okay. And then there I was. And I was an assistant. And then I worked my way kind of up from there.
And do you know that you want to be writing features for the magazine? Is that the goal? Do you know what kind of stories you want to be doing?
No. I mean, I was just like, I just wanted to have a job that seemed like it had a future, you know. Little did I know.
Awesome choice.
Little did I know. Exactly. But, you know, I started going out with Patrick McMullen, who's like a very well-known society photographer. So he would go to all of these fancy charity events, like fancy, only celebrities, only dignitaries, only, like, you know, the governor and the mayor and this and that. And I would tag along with him. He would take the photos, and then I would tag along, and I would ask, you know, dumb questions. And then I would write up a little 200-word kind of, this is what happened this week. It's kind of like a glorified, like, society column, but had, like, a little bit of edge to it because it had to have the voice of the magazine. And this is the first, like, real reporting that I did. And Patrick is this incredible creature. You know, he's like a Bill, you know, Bill Cunningham, who takes the pictures of the women in their different outfits for the style page and the Times. He's kind of like a similar person, but he's really boisterous, and he'll go up to, like, anybody, and he'll just be like, you know, Mayor Bloomberg, like, this is Vanessa Gregoriadis, and she's from New York Magazine, and she has something to ask you. And you're, like, in the party. You're not, like, on a red carpet. And, you know, Mayor Bloomberg is, like, standing there with, like, his wife and, like, you know, Jennifer Aniston, and you're just like, hi, Mayor Bloomberg, like, what was the last time you took the subway? What was it like? You know? And he's just like,
never writing questions down.
Stupid question. But, you know, it was this really kind of cool way to learn how to report, because it was terrifying. And I really don't get, like, that freaked out by a lot of stuff. This was really scary. It was really scary. You were really on the spot. You had to break up. Sometimes Patrick wasn't there, and I would have to walk up to, like, groups of people that were just, like, having cocktails and be like, hello. You know, and there's only, like, two or three reporters in those events, but New York Magazine was allowed in. So, you know, I did that, and that kind of got me, like, okay, this is, I'm into this. Like, I like the adrenaline of this. And then I wrote a story based on, you know, this is also, like, only something you would do if you were young. Because I was like, I go to these parties, and there are these women who are my age, and they stand at the door with a clipboard. Who are those women? I am so interested. And they are publicists. Oh, my God. What is that? I don't know what that is. And, you know, they particularly, I became interested in these fashion and society publicists who would like literally work for Louis Vuitton, and they would stand at the opening of like some new big Louis Vuitton store, and they would like anytime a socialite would come in, they would hand them like a handbag. So they would walk through a red carpet, and then maybe they would take the handbag back, or maybe the socialite would like steal it, or who knows what would happen. But anyway, I started kind of following them around, and I did this like really explosive, you know, obviously it's a very soft subject, but like very behind the scenes, like how does this all work? And a bunch of these girls had tried to make like an it girl out of one woman who worked at a boutique. She was just like a shop girl at a boutique. She was British. And they were like, we're going to get her interviewed by Vogue about like her highlights. We're going to get her in InStyle.
Basically, it's like a real life Mean Girls.
No, it was... Yeah, kind of.
I mean, I just reread the story. It basically is real life.
But yeah. It was like, yeah, like Emma or Clueless. Yeah, similar. Yeah. Similar, yes. It's the standard story. This is not the first time this story has been told. Women like to, you know, take the loser and make her a winner. And basically what happened is like she ended up having an affair with a real socialite's husband. And then they kind of like destroyed her after that.
How quickly did you go from like shagging quotes at parties to like blowing up people's spot in the magazine?
I mean, it was like 2 months later or something. It was insane. No, it was maybe like 6 months later. Yeah.
And did you, like, were you working on that story for a long time? Did it take you a long time to report?
I mean, it took me a few months. Yeah. I mean, I had written maybe one or two story, like actual real stories before then.
Were you nervous when it came out? I mean,
No.
It blows some people up.
I mean, apparently. It's hard to understand now from where we sit where, you know, the complexity of writing has been lost in a lot of ways. And there are a lot of very snarky blogs, and then there's a lot of very earnest reporting. But, you know, those things used to be really mixed together. Like, it wasn't, you know, when magazines and newspapers controlled the print world, you know, we controlled the information. So we could say the information however we wanted to say the information because we were the only people talking, you know. Obviously now the power balance is completely different. So I don't know. I mean, to me, you know, I come from this old New York magazine, very influenced by Spy, where we were just having a jolly good time in that office. And we were trying to make stories that made other people in the office laugh. Like, right. We just thought it was funny. You know, we were just trying to make stories that were amusing and funny. And so, you know, it wasn't about, like, blow this person up or not blow this person up. It was more just about, like, what's the best story that can be told.
Right. I mean, how would you describe it now?
You know, now New York Magazine is a really much more sophisticated product. It's a lot less, I hate to use the words text-oriented, but the actual print magazine is really a design product in some ways. It's, like, truly the most well-designed, most beautiful magazine, general interest magazine, I think. And it's hip and it's cool, you know, and the stories are supposed to reflect well on that brand. Whereas back in the day, New York Magazine was a kind of Tina Brown-esque thing where there was, you know, a lot of really, you know, grabby headlines and in-your-face reporting and some bad taste. You know, it's also changed. I mean, this is like maybe a little too granular since we're in Irvine, but it's changed from being a magazine that used to cover like the Upper East Side and the Hamptons and all the Tony places. Like, it's no longer like the Laguna Beach magazine. Like, now it's like, no, we're going to be a San Diego magazine. We're going to actually say, like, what's going on? What's the drivers of the economy? And like, how is this all working? And what are people who actually have like alternative ways of looking at things, you know, what are they doing? We're right. Not just going to cover what the rich people do, you know?
Let's keep the geographical thing going here for a second. So, like, you were in New York, and you were writing about people your age sort of in society. And then eventually you wrote a lot about sort of New York media and New York media culture. You wrote like a big piece about Gawker. That was kind of like one of the first big pieces about Gawker, which is totally hilarious to reread now. And then you moved to LA.
Right. For love.
For love. How did that move change your work? How did that move change the stuff you covered? Do you miss that New York media world?
Well, I do live in New York part-time, so I am pretty bi-coastal, but I can get like my, you know, fix of it if I need to. Well, I mean, I moved to LA in like probably 2006, maybe, really full-time. I also lived in Hawaii for 2 years in like an incredibly remote location where my husband was working, where like I lived in a like 200 square foot shack with like a golf cart battery because to like power the solar panels because we had no, it was off the grid. I mean, that was bananas. Like, and I was, you know, flying to do like Britney Spears articles like in California and then flying back there. And that was really odd. But I think that around that time, around 2006, obviously things started changing in media and it became much more digitally focused. And, you know, there was no real need for me to network with people in New York anymore. Like, first of all, I have the blessing really of writing that article that we were talking about the publicist, the Power Girls article, was really noticed by people because it was talking about something that is kind of taboo, which is journalists talking about publicists is a little dicey.
Right.
Like, it's a little dicey. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you so much, you know?
And that was like your second story.
Yeah. And they were also crazy about it. So they kept on calling the New York Post. And so it was very visible. So, you know, I was known to a lot of editors. Obviously, as a writer, you need to be known to editors. Editors are the people who have the power and they hire you and you get booked on stories almost like you're an actor. And they're like, okay, are you available? And you know what? As soon as I say, no, I'm not available, they just go to the next name on the list. I mean, a lot of the calls I get, I might be the sixth name on the list. Yeah, I mean, like, sometimes I get like weird calls about sports figures, and I'm like, I know I wasn't the first one. Okay, like, how many people have you now tried?
Are there ways outside of your work to stay at the top of that list? Like, how do you?
I don't think there are. I mean, I don't think there are. There's a lot of people, you know, long form writers. Like, obviously, you know, we haven't talked about like the sudden and decline in our job prospects. But, you know, long-form writers traditionally have, you know, Mike Sager's here. He does not live in New York. Walter Caron lives in Montana. Like, there's lots of people who live, some of the best people don't live in New York. And, you know, they don't want to put up with the bullshit. And also, like, if you're a journalist and you hang out with other journalists, how interesting is your work ultimately going to be? You're just listening to other people talk about the same stuff, which is really, unfortunately, one of the problems with becoming too into Twitter and too into, you know, Facebook or social media or, you know, your RSS feed. It's just like everybody's getting the same stuff. You have to think about the other stuff or at least about a different way of thinking about this stuff. And so I think the national magazine writer, long-form magazine writer who gets booked on stories and then gets on the plane and, you know, goes to either do Shakira or a small town murder is like, you know, an archetype that exists. And I then became one of those people because I did do a lot of national reporting. I started working more for Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone because they have a lot of stuff going on in LA.
How do you sort of balance those three magazines? So you're writing for New York and Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone. Do you have a certain number of articles every year that you're going to write for each one?
Yeah. I mean, I don't work for Rolling Stone anymore. So I write three articles that are long, so like 6,000-word articles for New York Magazine. And then I write a variable number for Vanity Fair. It's usually like 4 to 6.
And how many of those are stories that you have found and pitched?
Probably half.
Yeah. I mean, when I was like looking through your archive, it feels almost like there's like this like one for them, one for me thing going on. Like you're going to do a big celebrity profile, but then you're going to do a like small town murder story,
which
I assume those aren't assigned. Do you?
Sometimes they are. Sometimes they are and sometimes they're not, you know.
Do you like doing that crime stuff?
I love doing crime stuff. I just am not as interested in in traveling anymore because I have a baby now. So I don't think it's too fun to get on the plane without my baby and go stay like in a Radisson in Steubenville right now. Like I just don't, you know, like a friend of mine went and spent 2 weeks in Steubenville and she's going to have a great story. Like really, you know, and part of me is like, I wish I could have gone there too, but it's just not a time in my life where I have that ability. I mean, certainly from a financial standpoint, like I don't even know how I would do that. Like, would I take a nanny with me to Steubenville? You know, do I get a suite at the Radisson? I mean, you know, I've had conversations where I've been like, so you're going to fly me and my baby, right? And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay, so I guess I'll pay for the baby seat. Because I know after 6 hours with this baby on my lap, I'm not going to be in any, you know, state to work. So, like, even if I got a babysitter there, it just doesn't seem – at this point, I just don't think that – I can do, like, you know, a fast piece, 2 or 3 days in a location. But when you're dealing with something like the Steubenville rape story where you have, like, multiple characters may or may not talk to you, you have to go to wine and dine the lawyer and then this lawyer and then, oh, let's go find the high school teacher and the coach and the this, and you're, like, running around with your GPS knocking on doors. I mean, those things, they don't have an out date.
Right.
You know, like, I can't say to my husband, like, I'm going to Steubenville and I'll be back when I'm back. When I'm done.
Just doesn't fit in, just doesn't fit into your life anymore.
Well, it's just I've done a lot of stories like that. And I know, like, I've been the person who's, like, left Las Vegas and been, like, driving back to L.A. and had, like, you know, the madam call me and be like, oh, hey, yeah, I know I didn't answer my phone the last couple of days. I, like, lost it. But now I'm totally ready to meet with you. You know, like, just things like that happen all the time. You can't. You know, you can't – I remember when I started doing crime, there's a woman named Lisa DiPaolo who writes for GQ a lot now. And she doesn't seem to do that much crime now, but she used to do a lot of crime. And I remember talking to her. I was like, okay, tell me how you do this. And she was just telling me these stories. She was like, you know, last night I was in Paramus and I was sitting in a Dunkin' Donuts. Some guy was supposed to meet me there at 9 and I sat there till midnight and he didn't show up. And I was like, but you are Lisa DiPaolo. Like, how could he not – have shown up? And she was just like, it doesn't, like, you're always going to be seen in the Dunkin' Donuts right. till midnight. Like, it doesn't matter if you're like Anderson Cooper's producer or, I mean, obviously there's some, you know, 60 Minutes people, I'm sure they care more about that. But it just, there's always things get messed up. Always people are more difficult than you thought. Suddenly one source comes through and is amazing. You know, you can't figure it out.
So even if those stories don't sort of fit into your life as well now, you've done a lot of them, and maybe the students would be interested to know, like, what's your process when you're going after one of those kinds of stories, one of those like big crime stories where, like, what's your approach? How aggressive or in the background are you trying to be?
Well, again, you know, I'm not aggressive. Like, I want to see the weird details that daily reporters won't get. I want to get in that person's house. I want to see what their, you know, dishware looks like. I want to see if it's messy in there, if it's clean, and what the pictures are that they have around, and, you know, how they act towards me while we're talking. I mean, that's what I'm looking for. So I don't need to say to them over and over, like, did you kill this woman? You know, I think you did or whatever. Like, I'm not one of those pushy people who's trying to, like, be like, argh, because then they're just going to clam up and tell me to leave.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, that's really the distinction between people who do things that are longer. A lot of people who do things that are longer would never push people, you know.
And when you see those details, like, do you know the second you see your lead or your kicker, like, are you structuring the story in your head while you're reporting it, or do you, like, come back to, like, a giant pile of notes and start figuring it out?
I mean, I generally leave the scene once I know what the ending is. I pretty much can figure out the beginning, you know. I mean, after a certain amount of reporting, it's not that hard to figure out what the beginning of the story is. Once it clicks in my mind that this is the ending, then I'm like, okay, gotta go. There's a plane leaving. Bye. You know, like, that's
– right.
Yeah.
Then it's done.
Yeah. But I never really know what's happening in the middle. I mean, the way that I write is, as I said earlier, I ask a lot about childhood. in profiles particularly, but I think it works for everything. You can start just writing a mini biography of the person. Like, they were brought up in this place, single mom, had no food in the refrigerator, Justin Bieber story. You know, Justin Bieber, I think, like, slept on a pull-out couch. You know, he told me all this stuff about his childhood. It's also subjects people really like being asked about their childhood. So, you know, it creates a bond. But I usually write that first because that's the easiest thing to write.
Right.
And then you can kind of think, okay, well, that's – I'm going to drop that someplace in the middle. So what does the rest of this look like?
And then – you spent all this time with people. You spent a bunch of time with Justin Bieber, for example, and which sounds like you had a pretty good time. You appear in your stories a lot. And is that, like, do you know that that's going to be the case? Like, when you went down there, the lead of the Justin Bieber story is like, I kind of have a huge crush on Justin Bieber. And
yeah.
Did you, I mean...
which I decided I didn't after I met him, by the way. So
pretty immediately after meeting him. To your credit,
like,
I think.
I'm... a disgusting pervert. But yeah, I mean, I knew that that was going to be funny and there was going to be a payoff. Like, if I said, okay, I'm a woman in my 30s and I keep like watching these videos over and over, I'm like, he's so cute. Check this out. Oh my God. You know, like, there's going to be a payoff to that. I mean, truly, that was my experience that, like, you know, I normally really could care less what this person thinks of what I look like or what I'm wearing. You know, I'm in like my rumpled clothes I brought on the plane and, you know, I'm just concerned about if my recorders work. Like, I carry two recorders. I really suggest, if you decide to do this, you do not use an iPhone recorder and you invest in two, like, $30 digital recorders. You put a little rubber band around them. You have two. You don't have to worry that, like, is this on? Is it not on? Blah, 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 you know. And, like, I brought an outfit. I got an iron at the hotel. I ironed my outfit. They told me I was, like, going to go ice skating with him. So I, like, was like, oh, my God, we're going to go ice skating? Like, what's it going to be like? I don't know. Like, I'm so embarrassed. Should I, like, practice? I haven't been ice skating since I was, like, 10, you know. And, like, this Range Rover pulled up, and the door opens, and it's, like, this kid who is – I'm, like, 5'2", who is literally my height. Wearing, like, Invisalign braces, so he, like, pops them out, you know? Like, and he's, like, playing with them in his hand, and I was just – and he's, like, pumping rap music, and I was, like, no, this is not – and I was just, like, are we going ice skating? He was, like, that's corny. And I was, like, oh, okay. Like, let's go play pool. I was, like, all right, that's so much cooler. I wasn't looking forward to it or anything, but, you know, so – obviously, you're looking for the humor in the situation. If something like that happens, you have to seize it. I mean, in the story about Gawker that I had done, it's so funny that I might have to tell you guys what Gawker is, because there was a time when anybody who was involved in journalism definitely knew what Gawker was. But it was, like, at one time, a media industry gossip blog, plus some other information. But really, that's what they were kind of focused on, and they did this very smart thing where they got everybody in media reading it because they wanted to see, like, what are you saying about me? And then they kind of turned it into some, like, weird celebrity-oriented property that it is now. And but I wrote a piece about it and how I felt as, like, an old media journalist reading this new media blog. And I had, like, a whole story that didn't have anything to do with me. But that was the motivation in doing the story. I had interviewed the bloggers.
Yeah.
And
you were there even though you weren't really in the story.
Right. But then I went back and I actually changed the story because they had written something really mean about my wedding announcement. And I was just like, you know, I think, like, because the first draft that I turned in, my editor was like, I don't think this works. And I was like, OK, you know, I think I know it would work. And, you know, so I did it. And then it's like, you know, it's a double-edged sword because then I'm introducing people who didn't read the stupid blog item to, like, me being embarrassed about, like, being made fun of because I went to Wesleyan and, like, that my husband had worked for, like, a gay photographer. You know, it was just like, these people are such, like, hipster cliches, like, pathetic, you know. Yeah, I mean, you got to do what works. So if you put yourself in it, I don't need to be in it, but I would put myself in it if it will help me finish the task.
I assume that Gawker also, you know, skewered you after that story came out. What's the angriest anyone's ever been with you after a story?
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know if people are angry. I mean, I'm trying to think of, like, people being angry. You know, it's more like the silence is deafening. It's like if you don't hear anything, you know the person probably didn't like it. You know, that's basically what happens.
And you know that's, I mean, you know what you're doing while you're writing it. Like, you know the parts that are going to upset people. And
no, not at all.
Really?
No.
You're surprised by what pisses people off.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think being written about is a really pleasant experience for anybody. I certainly have had, like, some people write little stories about me or, like, study my work for a college assignment, and then I've seen the things that they've written, and I just don't think that's me, you know? And so I can't say, you know, I think in an interesting way, a lot of female journalists, and there's reason probably why there aren't a lot of long-form female journalists, in addition to the fact that travel is really hard with family, are a lot less convinced than male journalists that, like, this is part of what makes our democracy run. And, like, if they want the attention, they should let it all hang out. And, like, why wouldn't you talk to me? I'm going to knock your ass back and forth. Like, down. You know, I just read Charlie LaDuff, who's a fantastic writer, just wrote this book about Detroit. He was a New York Times writer. He went there. And he was, like, putting, you know, talking about him reporting in Detroit. And he was like, if he doesn't talk to me, I'm knocking his ass back and forth down Detroit Avenue. And, like, saying all these things. And I was just like, oh, my God, I would never say anything like this. Like, you know, I mean, the most I'll be is, like, if they don't cooperate, you know how things go. But, like, I'm pretty, you know, much a pushover in that aspect. Like, look, I think that in the past, I might have been more aggressive about some of the people that I wrote about. And I had a chip on my shoulder, and I had a lot more anger than I have now from years of therapy. And also just, like, you know, I feel like there's a trust that's going on. I'm getting – also, I mean, access has gotten so much harder that, like, getting good access, you're kind of like, all right, thank you. I'm in your house. This is great. You know, you're giving me grapefruit juice. I feel good about our experience here, and I'm going to try to portray it well. I do think that – I have a little bit of a weird tendency. Like, I'm always trying to do the counterintuitive thing. So I have a tendency to take people who aren't that well thought of by the media hive mind and say really great things about them and then maybe do the reverse. It's a little bit of, like, an authority kind of complex. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I just don't – I'm not, like, trying to speak truth to power the way that I used to be honest. Like, I felt a little bit more like – I'm going to, you know, really lay it all out here. And now I'm just kind of like, let's just make a story. This is entertainment. Like, ultimately, this is about people relaxing and getting, like, a good read. There's a whole group of people who are doing information, and I'm not one of them, you know? And I'm more in the entertainment area, I think, with my writing at this point.
What would your 26-year-old self think of that?
I mean... too hard question. What am I, 26? I don't know. I always had, like, a kind of I want to sleep well after this story thing happening. I always have felt somewhat conflicted, and I don't want to hurt people, you know, and I work in soft news areas for a reason. So I would be okay with it probably.
That seems like a good place to end.
Okay.
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you guys for sitting through that. And Vanessa, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Long Form. Thanks very much to Vanessa for taking some time pre-Coachella to talk to me. Thanks to UC Irvine for hosting us. There's a lot of good young journalists down there at UC Irvine. Warms a guy's heart. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lemmer. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our sponsors this week, the good folks at Tiny Letter. Use them to send your newsletters. And Audible. Use them to get a free audiobook. Go to audiblepodcast.com/longform. Get a free book. We'll see you next week.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk,
Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.